Hi, this is Ken McCarthy, and we're going to be talking today with John Rinaldi. Welcome, John.
Hello, Ken.
And we're going to talk about John's business and how he started it and the process of growing it and how it runs and how it operates and what he thinks is important about running and growing a business and some of the resources that he found along the way that helped him. And some of the guiding principles that he has learned through the trial and error, and how he's managing the current economic climate, which is certainly not the climate that we were in just a few short years ago. So, John, let's start. What was your basic training and education?
Well, I'm an engineer. I started out, got an electrical engineering degree. My father was an immigrant from Italy, and decided at some point that my brother and I were going to be engineers, and we really didn't have a choice about it. So he had a third grade education, and ended up going to night school quite a bit to finally get a, I don't even know he got a high school degree, but he always impressed education upon us, and so we went down the path that he chose for us, and I became an electrical engineer and went to work for a bunch of big companies. And pretty much hated every second of it.
Have you always been a Wisconsin guy?
Yeah, pretty much. I lived on the East Coast for a little while, but there was way too many people for me. I was over when I was here. I had one stoplight and 5 minutes to work, and then I went to Cape Cod one time on a Friday afternoon. You can imagine what that was like.
And you got there on Sunday.
Yeah, I decided that there's way too many people for, on the East Coast for me, so I came back here and suffering through the brutal winters we have. But we have the one thing we do have, which becomes more important resource every day, is water. We've got lots and lots of great fresh water here, which is going to be, an incredibly valuable resource over the next 10 or 20 years.
Absolutely. And for people that haven't made it to the Midwest, you know, Milwaukee and Chicago and that whole area, it's really beautiful in the right season.
Yeah, it's very much true. That one of the nice things is that we really enjoy summer here, as we call it. And we call that the summer, the days between July 3rd and July 5th.
There you go. But you take it for granted.
Yes, we don't take. We enjoy every second. The day it gets over 35 degrees, people put on shorts and start picnicking.
So how did you make the leap from employee to fledgling business owner?
Well, I probably did it the wrong way, the way a lot of technology people do it. And when I mean technology, I mean that in, I'd say, the absolute broadest sense. I would say a doctor is a technologist, a dentist is a technologist, a guy that knows how to, a mechanic is a technologist. And so somebody with some special skill, hates working for somebody else, decided, you know, I can do this for myself. And where that falls apart is that you invest all of your time in performing the service or creating the product, and you don't market it at all. And that led me down the wrong path. And I hate to tell you that I spent 15 just miserable years working that way. I can't believe that I had the perseverance to continue. The first year I was in business, I started out and made $42,000 in sales. And over the course of 15 years, we grew 2 to 5% a year, to the point of after 15 years, we had gotten it up to maybe $700,000 in sales.
Okay.
Then I made the big discovery, and over the last 5 years, we've grown 35% a year. So I think that everybody's going to be probably interested in what that big discovery or discoveries was.
Absolutely. And you know, we're talking about not liking being an employee, but then there may be people on this call who are, you know, maybe involuntarily not employees anymore. They may have a skill that's something that they're good at, something that clearly there's a market for, and they might be making the decision that, hey, you know, rather than be on this employment merry-go-round, maybe I should think about hanging out a shingle and doing this myself. It's a harder road, I think, I think that would be fair to say. I mean, it's kind of easy in a sense to go and punch a clock and do your job and go home at 5 or 6. It's a harder road to have your own shop, your own show. But in the long run, if you do it right, it is, in my experience, and yours too, John, it's an infinitely better road. But there's a sort of a price to admission. So your original focus was on, hey, I'm a really good electrical engineer. I can do all kinds of stuff. Hire us, and we'll do good stuff.
Right. You know, I sell to the manufacturing market, people who are building factories, operating factories, creating products for factories, and these people are very good customers, because if you sell them one thing once and it works very well, they will come back to you forever. And because it takes them time and effort to change to somebody else, you have a built-in customer for life if you continue to service them with stuff that works very well. Getting back to your other point, you know, one of the things people tell me is that what about security? I had a relative, say, at a Christmas party, and, you know, those are always kind of difficult for the entrepreneur. what are you working on? What are you doing? Because no one can relate to your life as an entrepreneur, as a business owner, unless they own a business. So I had a relative tell me about 4 or 5 years ago, you know, John, I could never do what you're doing. There's so much insecurity. And I looked at this person knowing that he and his wife work for the same large corporation in the same department across the aisle from each other. And I thought to myself, I have insecurity.
Oh,
and
God.
As you can imagine, first he was let go, and then 3 months later they kicked her out the door also. So they're both out on the street. And meanwhile, my business is growing, and we have a traditional, you would call it, bricks and mortar business. I have 13 full-time equivalents, probably about 11 full-time employees, and a bunch of interns that we use. So I don't see this as insecure at all, because I'm in very much in control of what's happening here, what we're doing, how we're dealing with the economy, and how we're going to move forward. So I don't see this as risky at all.
I have to agree. I have a relative who, same boat, been with his firm for God, at least 12 years. Very good at what he does. Very well liked by the clients, and there's a little political situation at this firm, and they're throwing people overboard in a panic, and he was one of the people they just decided to throw. He had one kind of year where he didn't bring in that much revenue, and they're using that as the measuring stick to get rid of him, and he's in a jam because not a good time to be looking for a job right now.
But what I think people miss, and I try to impress this, I hire a lot of college students here. That's the way I do my full-time staffing, because I get to look at them as from sophomore, junior, and senior years. I get that they're with me for at least 2 years, and no one can fool you for 2 years. You know, you bring in somebody for an interview, for a day-long interview, they can fool you. I mean, even in a couple of days, but over the course of 2 years, I know exactly what these people are like, how well they work, how well they fit in, and I either wish them well and on their way in the future, or I offer them a full-time job. And what I impress upon them is that the only security you have in life is the skills and the value you bring to the marketplace. And I think that's really not understood by a lot of people. That's what I have to do. I have to continue to use my company to develop, to bring value to the marketplace. But I tell the people that work for me, you have to bring me skills and bring value to the company. And I don't care how. I tell them, and this always makes their eyes bug out. I say to the summer interns, I hope in 5 years that I'm paying you $175,000 a year, because you're delivering that much value to me and making us that successful, that you're worth $175,000. I said, that's certainly possible if you work on building up that value that you have.
And this is something that people will only hear in a business run by a real entrepreneur. You know, if you go to work for a big company, their task is to keep your salary down.
Right.
And certainly to keep it in line, you know, with everybody else. But But if you're working for somebody like John or me or somebody that, you know, is very close to the ground and really, engaged in the real world, our dream is to have somebody come in and be worth this kind of money to us.
Absolutely. I have a guy that came in as a sophomore in college. He worked for me for 2 years. I think I paid him $8 an hour. But he mm-hmm. became so good at the software we produce and some of our electrical products that he came in with a list of, I won't call them demands, but such that that's what it was on the week before graduation or shortly before graduation. And I looked over his list. It included an incredible salary. And I said, okay. he was that valuable to me to the point he made himself so valuable to the corporation that I was willing to give him whatever he wanted.
This is so important. You know, it's not just about, a lot of people think food comes from the supermarket, and a lot of people think money comes from showing up at the job and punching the clock in and out. And it's just not where it comes from.
Yeah, absolutely right. Absolutely right. So I hope that's a real big takeaway for everybody who's working a full-time job or thinking about going off on their own, is that you have to think in what kind of value can you deliver to the marketplace. And I think this is a great time. You know, no matter what the economy is, it's a great time. If you're competent at what you do, you use the kinds of marketing skills and strategies and tactics that you teach, that it's an excellent, there's always room for another great provider in the marketplace, no matter what it is that you do.
You know, and as you know, I'm sure you come up against this. I come up against it all the time. There are lots of times I need something done, and I'm just dying to try to find a reliable, capable person to do it.
That's right. Exactly.
You know, I'm looking all over, high and low, and either the people out there aren't delivering, or they're just not getting their message. You know, if they do deliver, they're not getting their message to me that they can deliver.
Exactly. And price does not become an issue, though. When you find somebody that's competent, reliable, and something you need, well, you'll pay more for that.
Absolutely. In fact, I'm in this situation right now where I'm going to be. Looks like I'm going to be paying, 30 to 40% more. Actually, forget that. 60 to 70% more than I really wanted to pay for something. But I realize, you know what? These guys are good. I'm going to give them the job. They're going to do it. They're going to turn it around. They're going to hand it back to me finished. No blood pressure, escalation.
Exactly.
No hassles. It's just going to be done. So hey, it's worth the money so that I can get on to do what I'm doing.
Sure.
Better.
You take anybody that does that any service business at all. If you deliver it reliably, efficiently, competently, you can be successful at it. But on the other hand, you also need to use the kinds of marketing, as I said, strategies and techniques that you teach in order to really build that business.
And, yeah, so we're really looking at two things. One is three things, really. Knowing the marketplace that you want to go into and really understanding what that marketplace wants and is looking for,
mm-hmm.
creating something or sourcing something for that market, and then letting that market know you're there and letting them know that you're the first guy they should be thinking of, and you're the first guy they should try when they're looking to do something new.
And that's exactly where I fell apart when I started. For those 15 miserable years,
mm-hmm.
I was a very competent, reliable deliverer of engineering projects and software in my particular marketplace, but I had absolutely no marketing skills. I was of the mind, as most technologists are, again, broad technology, mechanic, I would consider a technologist, I wasn't very good at telling the marketplace that I was here and what I was trying to deliver and identifying the who I was trying to talk to and talking in a way that they would understand.
You've been a great student of marketing, especially in the last, would you say, 4 or 5 years.
5 years.
Let's talk about the real life experiences and insights. So in other words, you went out, you learned some stuff from various sources, system included, but a lot of other people too. So that's good. But now let's talk about what you actually did. You can go to a class and you hear something and you go, oh, that makes a lot of sense. Okay, that's good. That's sort of step one. But the most important step is you take that piece of learning to the real world. You try it out, you get the feedback, and then all of a sudden you really know it. So let's list it maybe in chronological order if you can. We'll start with the first one, the second one, the third one until we run out of...
There's probably hundreds of things that I've done, and I can't pin... there are some ones I think that are more important than others, some realizations and that I think I made that probably really influenced the success I had over the last 5 years that I didn't understand over the first 15. So let's go through some of those. I think the first one was that I was I was a technologist and I wasn't really willing to be a marketer and salesperson for my products and services.
So
and
part of it just had to do with outlook and attitude and
that's
how you were. Okay.
And for the most part, I think that was probably the biggest change for me was the realization that I had to change my attitude. I couldn't be over there on the other the other side of the wall from where I am now, where they do the engineering. I couldn't be over there tapping away at a keyboard creating software. I had to be a marketer and salesperson.
You could do that, but your income would be a lot less.
That's exactly right. That's exactly right. And there's people who I have that do that better than I do. So I remember I was pretty desperate. After 15 years, I had a very low salary. The company wasn't doing very well. We were constantly in debt. So I got a call from Perry Marshall, and Perry told me about some Dan Kennedy stuff. He told me about the system, and I was like, okay, I'm in. Where do I go? Where do I sign up? And I gotta try something different. So the first thing was I was open and receptive when people told me that, hey, here's a place you can go for some new ideas. Okay, God that I didn't say. And I hear this all the time now when I try to do the same thing Perry did for me, mm-hmm. is to say, well, yeah, I'll do some of that when I get some money. Because I have told, there's dozens and dozens of dozens of guys just like me, engineers who hated working for big companies, decided to open up their own shop, and, they're technologists, but they're unwilling to step out of the technology role and become a marketer and seller and learn those techniques and those skills. And consequently, they're still back there struggling from year to year, trying to make a living, trying to survive for one more year, but they just won't step away. So luckily for me, I had the attitude, the understanding that I had to do something radically different, and I did.
Now, I wonder if the reason people resist learning how to market and learning to be a salesman, a salesperson, saleswoman, some people are just, for some people that's their first entree into work, the world of work. They start as salespeople, where they find themselves in a marketing department, and they get to learn the ropes and they see what it's about. But a lot of people, their first experiences with work, they're not involved in sales. They're involved in the doing, and sometimes, deservedly or not, the sales and marketing departments don't have good reputations. I mean, I'll give you an example. When I used to do technical writing a long time ago. And so there were the engineers like you who create the product. Then they'd hand the product off to me, and I'd try to make it comprehensible to the end users. And then there was this sort of nebulous marketing department that always seemed to be on another planet that would always be issuing these seemingly crazy commands, oh, yeah, we have to launch this product next week. Oh, you don't have a manual yet? Well, just write it. Just get it ready for the launch next week. And I was like, I did that for the very first ISDN. Is that ISDN? Is that right? I can't remember. DSL. No, DSL. The very first DSL modem, which came out from Hayes back
right.
in 90.
Oh, boy.
Well, I had a manual for that. And I had, I think, 10 days to write it from the time they handed me the box and the engineer's notes to the time the thing had to be ready for the printer. I mean, it was and that was driven by marketing. And then, of course, we have the Dilbert cartoon where marketers are always portrayed as, the devil. And then there's sort of the stereotype of the salesman, slapping you on the back, trying to you know, close you on some terrible deal, you know, that you really shouldn't be in. And so there's all these myths about what marketing is and what selling is, and a lot of people say, oh, I don't really want to be part of that. And I wonder if that's...
You know, that's partly true, too. I had an experience on vacation. Went to a wedding, a cousin's wedding down in Mexico at a resort. And I mentioned at dinner one night that I had brought three books with me to read that week. And my cousin's son, who's 22, finishing his history degree, said to me, "Oh, you're wasting your vacation." And I said to him, "Well, Michael, what do you plan to do when you graduate? Why don't you think about a sales career?" "Oh, I don't want to lie to people."
Wow, yeah.
I thought, oh, this is he's going to be 10 years from now. He's going to be driving a car he doesn't like. He's living in a house he doesn't like. He's going to be wishing he had more money. He's probably going to be in credit card debt. I could see his future because he's not open. And I feel bad because I like the kid, but there's, you know, I can't drill anything into him.
No. And in the problem, the terrible thing is there are the salesmen that are most obvious in the world are the bad ones.
Yeah,
you know, if you're a bad salesman, you're very obvious, and people go, "Oh my God, you know, let's get away from this." And
you're right about these kind of people, and I'd like to talk about the technologists. You know, the including the dry cleaner, the mechanic, the doctor, the chiropractor, plus all the engineers. You know, what I find in all these people is that they have a love of doing whatever it is that they're good at doing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they're good at, they want to adjust, the chiropractor wants to adjust backs, the mechanic wants to fix cars. You've got to, if you want to become an entrepreneur, you've got to break yourself of that and say, yes, I'm a mechanic is my background, but my job now is to market and sell auto mechanic services and products. Not to fix cars. You know, if you can't make that distinction, say I'm going to change my orientation and how I think of myself, then just keep working for somebody else. If that's all you want to do.
I mean, you still maintain the quality of what you're doing and your commitment to it, but now you add this additional commitment, which is, you know, I'm not going to sit under a rock here. I'm going to get out there. And make sure people know I'm around, know what I can do for them.
Because these people believe that what they do is the most important part of the business, and that's what's wrong. Is the most important part is not the product or service that you have. The most important part of the business is the marketing and selling of what it is that you do. And they can't make that distinction, because if you love fixing cars, you can't make – it's very difficult to say – well, the most important part of this business is the marketing and selling of these services, not the actual fixing of the car.
Mm-hmm.
Hard to make that change.
Well, you know what I say to people, and sort of the thing that guides me is, you know, look, if you're really good at this, as good as you say you are, you know, you really are doing the world and your market in particular, and the people in it, a grave disservice. If you're not studying and figuring out how best to package what you do and get it out there and get it sold, I mean, you're actually hurting people, you know. Because let's take the example of a chiropractor, since you brought that up. If someone really is a good chiropractor, by them not being willing to do all the things it takes to get the word out and bring people in and enroll them, they're actually leaving the market open to maybe chiropractors that aren't as good.
Exactly.
You know?
Exactly. That's very true. That's very true.
You know, I once heard this saying, and this also has guided me for years. I wish I could remember where I got it originally, but it's a Japanese folk saying, believe it or not. And it's something that farmers either say, or they may even sing it. There may even be a song. I don't know. I wish I knew the source of whoever originally found this. And what the Japanese farmers said in the olden days was, "What I grow by the sweat of my brow, I have to sell by the sweat of my brow." You know? And, that's the piece.
That should be on the desk of every entrepreneur.
Yeah. Because we're all like, "Oh, man, I already did the job." I think part of the problem is, if I can be a social philosopher here a little bit, is unfortunately people have been trained expertly on how to be consumers and live the consumer lifestyle, which includes doing as little work as you can possibly get away with.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of people think, oh, my God, I'm doing the job really well. You mean I have to go out and sell it, too? And my answer, and I think your answer, too, John, is yeah. Because and you'll be
here's one of the things that's guided me for the last 5 years in that regard, is that what if I make lousy products, but I'm a really good marketer, I can still survive in business and make money. I'll do
mm-hmm.
much better if I have great products. But if I have great products and lousy sales and marketing, it's going to be a disaster, and I may not survive.
Yeah.
So absolutely,
and many a talented person, unfortunately, has not gotten their just rewards because the marketplace didn't know about them.
Right.
Maybe this is another attitudinal thing. which has just occurred to me is like I think a lot of people have sort of the Cinderella complex, and I'm including some men in this too, that somebody's supposed to come along someday and recognize their great talent. I have a feeling that the number of times that's happened in the history of the world probably boils down to the Cinderella fairy tale. It probably has never happened in human history where somebody has just been sitting around and someone else came along and said, wow, you're talented, let me do all the selling for you, and you just sit back and be the star.
I've seen in the engineering world that happens. There's the version of that is, I'm going to create this product, and it is so wonderful, so incredible. People are gonna just break down my door to get it, and it never happens. So then 2 years later they create a different product. Okay, I got it now. They never really use marketing to drive that traffic to them to actually drive the demand.
Well, there's two problems there. One is they may be creating a product in a total vacuum. In other words, they have such a sketchy connection to the real marketplace that they don't even know what would be a hit, what wouldn't be a hit. You know, they just, something pops in their mind one day, their adrenaline kicks in, they decide, independent of the rest of the world, that it's a great idea, they go and develop it, and it may just be totally off point.
You're driving to something that's been another major philosophy of mine over the last 5 years, is that the who is the most important piece of information you can have and use.
Mm-hmm.
Who you're going to sell to, knowing everything there is to know about that buyer is incredibly important. And how to talk to the buyer, the message that goes around in the person's head, exactly what emotional buttons you can push, that is the most, that's the next critical thing to having a successful business.
You know, there's a great saying from Amarillo Slim, you know, the legendary poker player, and he said, "Play the other player, don't play the cards."
Mm-hmm.
No.
That's
yeah, you got to know the cards. You got to know the royal flush beats a flush, but you know, you better know who's on the other side of that table and what's going on in their minds and what they're thinking. And, you know,
I have an interesting story in that regard. I sell a product that is essentially a very common product sold by maybe half a dozen other companies. Every one of the other companies advertises it in terms of technology. That, you know, here's this thing, a Zing, let's say. Okay, you can use we have a Zing device. Buy our Zing device, okay? I advertise the same thing, but I realize that that's not the conversation in the customer's head when they wake up in the morning saying, boy, where am I going to get that technology today?
Mm-hmm.
I know that they have a problem that they want to solve, and the problem is I need to move X data over to Y, to a Y place.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? So they have that problem, and that's the problem in their head. So I market my box as a device that will move things from X to Y.
Mm-hmm.
And on the web, people go on the web and type, how do I, you know, move things from X to Y? They come to my site and they buy my product.
Mm-hmm.
All of my competitors insist on marketing the technology. And
mm-hmm.
so I'm I'm lucky that they don't quite understand that marketing principle about the who being very important and understanding the conversation in the customer's head.
We recently had this experience here. We were looking for someone to execute on some social marketing stuff on the internet. And so somebody recommended somebody to us very highly, and we talked with the guy. And he was so intoxicated with the technical details of what he did. And he showed almost zero interest in trying to understand what we were trying to accomplish. That was just like not even on his radar. And that's kind of like the exact wrong way to approach. You should be 99% interested in what your customers and prospects are trying to accomplish. And then, assuming you have the right solution for them, showing them how your solution does that. That's the right sequence.
I had talking to a customer a couple of weeks ago, and the customer used some words. He goes, "Oh, that's a device converter." "Oh, that's right." I said, "Yes, you're right. It's a device converter." So, boom, as soon as I got off the phone, changed all the marketing literature to call it a device converter. Learned that's how at least this one customer who was refers to it. So I figured, well, if he's talking about it like that, then other people are talking about it in the same way. I've got to match that how they talk about it and what they see as the problem. So that was kind of a second thing that I changed. Another thing was that I made a real commitment to education. Okay, I've been a system member now for 5 years. I belong to Get Glazer Kennedy Inner Circle. I get marketing from both you and from them, and then I expanded and said, boy, I need to learn how to do sales. So I contacted John Mendocha and learned, and he taught me an incredible amount about sales. And then I got involved lately over the last 2 years ago. I realized I had learned a lot of strategies and techniques, but felt that there was just something wrong. I was missing something, and that missing piece for me turned out to be the psycho-cybernetic stuff that Matt Fury teaches. So I found a whole set of coaches in different areas that have all provided me with complementary information from a different kind of viewpoint that all has just fit together. And I've decided to, and I'm spending probably in the neighborhood of $20,000 a year on all of this coaching, and I wouldn't give it up for a second.
And you hit all the major areas from Dan Kennedy, classic, bread and butter, direct marketing, which we should probably get into on this call because it's so important. And then, from us at the system, internet marketing technique, the real stuff, not the hot air stuff, but the real bread and butter stuff. Yep. And then, of course, John Mendocha, great sales trainer, and there's just all kinds of things about the mechanics of selling that if you can find someone to teach them to you, you're very lucky because it will save you a lot of trial and error.
Oh, yeah.
And then, of course, the psycho-cybernetic stuff, created by Maltz, Dr. Maltz.
That's right.
And then I believe Matt acquired rights to that material and is packaging it and presenting it, which has to do with your own psychology,
And again, I see so many people when I tell them about it, they're just amazed that I spend $20,000 a year on all this. Plus, I don't know if that includes all the books that I buy. They're just amazed the amount of money I spend on this. And I said, I actually can tell you a story right now of how I made probably hundreds of thousands of dollars from one thing in a Perry Marshall newsletter. It was ABC Selling. I had a product that I sold for $7,000 only because I had a competitor selling it for $6,000 and said, well, I want to get a little more. Well, Perry explained ABC Selling, how you have you make the customer look at your three choices and decide which choice of yours he should buy, as opposed to is it yours versus the competitor's.
Uh-huh.
So I took my $7,000 product, I stripped everything out of it, and I made that a $9,000 product. I increased the price of the $7,000 product to $17,000, just added $10,000 to it. And to make that look cheap, I created a 7 deluxe version at around $30,000 because I wanted to make the $17,000 one look like the right choice. Immediately, everybody started buying the $17,000 one that would have bought the $7,000 one.
Wow. Now, some people may be going, oh, my God, these numbers are astronomical. I don't sell anything like that. But the principle is the same. So let's explain to people why you think this works so well, the psychology of it.
The concept is that people generally don't, if it's something that they really need, that they don't want to buy the cheapest one because they're afraid that it's not going to work very well. Like today I had to go off and buy a new snowblower. And I certainly wasn't going to buy a cheap one because the last thing you want when you walk outside and you've got a foot of snow in your driveway is a snowblower that's going to break down on you.
Mm-hmm.
So, but I also knew that I didn't want the deluxe model that, you know, has the hood all the way around it and the little television and the GPS and everything else, you know, because I wasn't going to spend $50,000 on this thing. So I bought an intermediate model because that's the one that wasn't the basic, but it had enough features to give me more. So it does two things. It really gets the customer thinking about all the different choices that they have from you, as opposed to should they buy it from you or from somebody else. And so the principle is they don't want, no one really, very few people want to buy the deluxe model. But when they look at here's another thing I learned. When you present these to a customer, I always present them highest one first. Because I have a $35,000 package for you. Now, you're probably not going to need all this, but here's what you get in the $35,000 package. Then I say, but now you can also get, you probably don't need all those things, so I have a $17,000 package for me. And you can always kind of hear the person go, oh, well, that sounds reasonable. Well, of course, if they're just thinking about spending $35,000 or $30,000, and now you say, well, now I have one for $17,000. Well, that certainly sounds reasonable. And then I say, you know, and some people really just don't have the funds available, don't have the budget for that. I've got another one that'll get the job done, but you're going to have to invest a lot more time and effort and resources on your end to use it. But some people who can have the extra time to market can do this, and that one's only $7,000 or $9,000, whatever the number is. So I've stepped them down, and those numbers now look cheap when you start off with that really big number first. So there's a couple of different principles involved there.
Great. And again, this applies to whatever you are selling. It doesn't matter what it is. This is just a matter of imagination. You know, you figured out, okay, what if I created the world's ultimate version of this package? You know, you probably sat down one day with a blank piece of paper and a pen and just started, you know, thinking and writing things down.
Yeah, I add for $35,000, I actually send an engineer on site to them.
Okay.
And I guarantee, I said, he'll get it done for you in 2 days. Now, you'll be done in 2 days. So that's essentially the equivalent of you want your drapes cleaned. Well, we'll come to the house. We take them down for you. We take them away. We clean them, and then we bring them back to the house and hang them for you again. I mean, the whole full service. And you say, that process costs you, I don't know what, I have no idea what this might cost, say $259. But,
right.
You know, if you can't afford to spend $259 and you want to bring them to us, well, that's only $129. Now $129 sounds very reasonable when you had them thinking about the $250 one.
Absolutely.
So it works no matter what the numbers are. That the way you approach it, if you always talk about the high number first and then back off, now they're considering not whether they're going to have you clean the drapes or the other guy across the street clean the drapes, but should they take your $250 package, the $129 package, or the special $65 one where I don't know what you do for that, but some, you know, lesser service. It doesn't have the Scotch guarding or whatever it might be.
Right. Maybe there's some special treatment at the mid-range that you don't do at the. And, you know, I've seen, I when I, there's a car wash around here, And what do you think they do? They've got, actually, they may overdo it. They've got five choices.
Yeah,
and if I'm feeling cheap, I can go through for $9.95. If I'm feeling flush, I can pay $39.95. And
yeah,
they do all kinds of amazing things to the car.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
Exactly right. It works in every industry. Doesn't, and the price, the numbers don't matter. In my market, and what's nice about my market is that it's not this guy's money. You know, the guy I'm dealing with, he has a budget, but it's not, he's not really taking the, opening his wallet, and it's not costing him $17,000. He's just, he's committing his company to that. So I'm a little bit, and so what's interesting about my market is, see, my customer doesn't care about the money. He just doesn't want to show up in a meeting 6 months from now, and somebody's going to say, why did you buy that lousy product from John Rinaldi? Why didn't you buy the more expensive one that had all the features, and we wouldn't have had these problems? You know, he doesn't want to be embarrassed and have this hurt his career. That's the worst side for him. What I'm getting to is, I really understand the guys I'm working with, okay? Because I understand that's their major goal, is to get promoted, to get a raise, and not be embarrassed.
Mm-hmm.
And so they're willing to spend more money if I can show them that this is less risk, the project's going to get done on time, they're going to look good, and they can go to their boss and say, hey, I've delivered all this, it's working, I found a great supplier, and everything's going well. That's what
great.
They want.
And this sounds, this may sound like a simple idea, but it's very powerful, and it kind of falls in the category of packaging. I mean, you already have your product or your service. You already know what to do and how to render it. And this isn't just an issue of, okay, how do we package what we do in such a way to make it, palatable and understandable and motivate people to pay attention to our offer, number one, and then two, to take action. And so by offering the choices, you get attention, because most of your competitors won't even bother.
Right.
You know.
So I can tell you that over the 10 years I've been using this, that single newsletter from Perry Marshall has made me $300,000. So I shake Perry's hand and say thank you every time I see him. little recompense.
Excellent. Yeah, really. People sometimes think, guys teaching marketing, they're getting rich. Well, I would love to have 1% of all the revenue I generated from my material, and I'm sure it'll be more than I charged for it.
Let me go back to one of the biggest things that I learned from Ken McCarthy.
Oh, what's that?
The thing that I learned from you that I had never really understood before is this progression, and there's another step to this whole process we've been talking about starting out as a technologist, then deciding, in my case, I've got to learn marketing and sales because that's the most important part of what has to happen. And then after that, deciding that, okay, I've got that under control, I've actually got to become an investor and look at the business as an investment that's going to generate money for me and make sure that I'm getting, that it's operating efficiently in that respect. That's the next step. And you did a wonderful job of explaining that. You probably don't remember. It was at the San Francisco club meeting we had the day before the system seminar. Boy, I don't know how many years ago that was now.
Well, this was a model I was offering it originally cooked it up for people that are in the information business. And I said, look, most people are Most of you guys are writers, which is great.
That's right. Now I remember. You're right.
Yeah.
It was about writing.
Yeah, but then I adapted it, though. I adapted it to other fields as well. And I was trying to think of why so many people get hung up on information marketing and why so many writers don't make money and, how can I get this idea across? And I said, well, look, here's how it goes. You start out as a writer, and you love writing. You're in love with writing. You're good at it. You're cranking it out. Everything's great. But then you realize you're really not making much money, And so then you say, well, it's publishing. Publishing's where it's at. I'm going to just self-publish my own stuff, which is good. And instead of waiting around for someone to recognize your talents or trying to get somebody to publish you, you start publishing your own stuff, which is a step up. And then after you've been a publisher for a while, then you realize, wow, I got a bunch of stuff that in my inventory that needs to be sold. How do I sell this stuff? And that's when you become a marketer. You know, and then after you've done that for a while and it's starting to work and you're starting to make money, you start to realize how much flexibility there is and how much of your success depends on your business judgment, at which point you start looking at things. I say like a banker, another phrase is an investor, and that's where you start realizing, you know, gee, this thing that I created is kind of a money machine, and if I take care of it well, it could make even more money. And if I build it on a really solid footing, it can make money for a long, 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 long time. Why don't I start looking at what I'm doing that way? So that's so radically different from the writer that's trying to get something published or the engineer that's trying to sell a one-off product or a one-off contract. But that's for business and for, you know, we started this conversation talking about security. The ultimate insecurity is you're in a marketplace that's alive, you understand it, you figured out how to serve it, you've got all kinds of offerings for it, you've got a well-oiled machine delivering those offerings, and you've got another well-oiled machine getting your marketing message out, making sure people know what you're doing, and you're approaching them and dealing with them in the best possible way. And the marketing and sales is what makes the business happen. Without that, you just don't have business. So before we go on to the next topic, I just want to reiterate, for anybody on this call that's not sold yet on the idea of learning sales, learning marketing, because you think it's somewhat shady. I mean, the answer is, yeah, there are definitely some shady operators in sales and marketing, no question. But that, you know, there's shady operators in every field. I mean, we're discovering that all these, you know, captains of industry and on Wall Street turn out to be not so impressive after all. And I mean, you're always going to find people not doing the right thing. But when you look at sales and marketing, when done correctly, when done ethically, when done skillfully, when done with an attitude of service in mind, it's a great thing to do. I mean, you're going out, you're finding people with problems and you're solving their problems.
That's exactly the point I was going to make. When people come to me, the guy, like, you know, for instance, has got a laser cutter, and what he does is he adds that to a diaper machine and actually cuts out the legs for diapers. And when they make diapers, I don't know if you know this, but they make something like 45 a second.
Wow.
They just shoot out of there like crazy. So his machine has to do that, is a laser that cuts the forms out. And so he needed me to help him access more factories and be able to sell that machine to more customers. And so I was, you know, by helping me to find the right package of software and hardware to sell him, I was doing him a great favor, because when we got done, he had a whole new market to sell his machine to. So it's done very ethically with service in mind. Okay, so maybe, you know, and if he needed it quickly, I had the high-end package where I sent an engineer to him and get it done right away. I had the very low-end package for him if he didn't have the funds available, the budget, but he could still get it done. It would just take more time. So I was, I'm providing a service to him, and the reason I'm getting paid is because I'm delivering value to him in that regard. So selling is very important to this.
Absolutely. I'll even go so far as I think it's heroic, you know, because it's a lot easier to sit on your couch or sit in your office chair and not, you know, risk anything, you know, not put yourself out there.
You just hit on something that just drives me insane. I had a guy work for me one time. I employed him because his company went bankrupt, and I knew the guy, and I said, well, why don't you come work for me? I'll pay you like half salary, but you look for a job, and maybe you're going to work for me for one day, maybe you can work a week, maybe a month, and we'll see what goes on. But, well, it turns out as soon as he started working for me, he quit looking. But he started complaining all the time. This guy had a choice. He could have, to what we've talked about before, decided he was going to make himself so important and valuable to the organization that I'd have to pay him more money, or he could just complain about it. Well, he took the complaining route, made everybody miserable. I had to go on a day-long trip with this guy, and he was whining to me, I don't have any money for vacations, my wife has to work, I'm not saving any money for retirement, on and on and on. And I said to him finally, I said, I forget what his name was, and I said, so what do you do at night when you get home from work? Because at 4:30, he is out of here like a bullet. So So I said, what do you do every night? He says, well, generally I just sit in the recliner with the cat on my lap. And I thought to myself, you're waiting for success to come, not only knock on your door, but come bursting through the door, grab you out of the recliner, and drag you into the street.
Oh, my God.
Apparently, and you know, so there he was, you know, unhappy with his life, but not willing to take an ounce of effort to change it. And
well, you know, since you brought that particular character type up, by coincidence, this might be really helpful to people that are hiring and building organizations and finding people to work with. I was listening to the radio yesterday, literally, and there was a scientist on there, a social scientist, talking about workplaces and successful workplaces, and is it possible for one bad apple to really mess up a whole workplace? And the answer is yes.
Absolutely.
You know, and then he said, okay, and here are the personality types we found that are bad apples, you know, that can cause disruption. One of them, one character type, is the complainer. That was one of the first ones he mentioned. Person who, in fact, there's a book out right now for businesses. I forget the title, but it's basically the no complain rule. In other words, this guy's idea, it's kind of interesting in a way, is that the way to achieve success in a workplace is outlaw complaining. Just outlaw. It's just not allowed. So the complainer, the chronic complainer is a big drag on business. The other one is the slacker. The person who's trying to design his or her day to do as little as humanly possible, and let everybody else carry the ball. And then, of course, the third one is just the real, truly negative person, you know, the naysayer and the bad mouther. And so, I mean, those are the three people. If you ever run into them, you don't want them in your organization because they just...
Are you familiar with the Garcia story?
Garcia. I do know it, but do tell it. That's a really good story that I think about actually a lot.
This is we actually have a Garcia Award in our company.
Okay.
And I'll tell you the Garcia. This happened during the Spanish-American War. There was a guy, an army command that was in the mountains in Cuba, and no one quite knew where they were, and the Allies had to get a message to this army unit that was in the mountains. So they brought the first guy in, and they said, we'd like you to take a message to Garcia, who's in the mountains. And the guy said, well, does it have to be done right now? I'm kind of busy. And the next guy, you're not the right guy. So they bring the next guy in. The next guy says, well, what's in the message? Well, that's none of your business. Get out of here. So everybody, it came in, you know, another guy, can I do it a little later? I don't know that I could, where is he? You know, well, we don't know where he is. So the idea is that everybody who comes in has an excuse for not getting the job done right now. So finally one guy comes in and says, okay, I'll do it, grabs the message and goes through the mountains, goes through the swamps and through the rivers and finds Garcia and delivers the message. So we actually give an award out in our company called the Garcia Award winner. We've got this little trophy. It's actually a bowling trophy that we modified, and you get to keep that at your desk as the Garcia Award winner for doing something outstanding, just taking the bull by the horns without being told and doing an outstanding job.
Oh, yeah. That's a great thing to bring to the workplace and hold up as a high model.
Yeah. So if you go on the internet and you say Garcia story, you can find that story in much greater detail than I just told it. So if anybody wants that, it's available.
Well, let's talk about direct marketing, which may be a new term to some of the listeners. And of course, I learned a lot of my direct marketing principles from and through Dan Kennedy, and I know you did too. And of course, that was the first seminar that Perry brought you to. Was there any particular thing that jumped out at you, that has jumped out at you over the years that you got from Dan's approach to direct marketing that has proven to be a huge help or breakthrough?
Well, I think we talked about a couple of them. The who is the first thing. Knowing, you know, that's the absolute place to start, is you've got to start with who am I selling to, and Dan has a great set of criteria for that. Number one, are they reachable? Is it might be a great market? Do they have money? Can you get to them? and things like that. There's a couple of different criteria. So that was the first thing that I got through that. And then another thing was being able to talk to them in their language, really understanding what they are, finding out where do they hang out, how do they talk, what language do they use, and then reflecting in that, really trying to understand that market. I consider that as the most important place to start. If you don't know the market, then you're really screwed. I got enamored after coming to System Seminar, of course, with info marketing, which is totally different than my bricks and mortar business. Decided that I would start an info market. I don't know if I ever told you this story.
I don't know. You haven't.
So I did it the typical way an engineer would. I created a spreadsheet and I created 45 criteria and I evaluated like 60 or 70 different info markets.
Oh my God!
I went way overboard, as a math guy would, and created weighted criteria and the whole bit. And coming out of that, found out that scrapbooking, this is like 5 years ago, would be a great market for me to be in. So I did an ask campaign to find out, to get some, what is the marketplace thinking about, and I had a book made, and I did all of the steps that were so copiously detailed in the system seminars. And what I found out at the end when I got all done was I really didn't like scrapbooking at all. I had no affinity for the market. I had no interest in it. Then I got the whole thing, I got to the end, put the whole site up, and I just didn't want to bother. I just hated to look at it because I just had no interest in it at all. And so it was just a terrible idea. So you have to have an affinity for the market. You have to enjoy that particular market, because otherwise it's really hard to work in a market that you don't like.
Yeah, as I was saying to a group the other day, is everything gets old after a while. So you better be doing something that you can reignite your passion for on a regular basis.
I've been looking for something to do as for info marketing, and I haven't really found anything. But getting back to direct marketing, one of the things that we try to do here is really stand out. And I have somewhat of a luxury in that my customer base, which is these engineering folks that want to do this stuff, no longer get much direct mail. I mean, everybody sends them everything in emails. I mean, they get hundreds of emails a day. So it's impossible to stand out on an email. So we actually are going to do, in 2009, we're going to double the amount of direct mail that we do. We're going to double the frequency of the newsletter. We're going to enhance our campaigns for postcards. I've had wonderful success with postcards, cheap postcards, that have all text, no pictures, no white space. And, in fact, I generated a customer that has been worth to me someplace in the neighborhood of $400,000 or $500,000 over the past 6 years, just based upon a postcard. And one of the key interesting things I found with postcards, when I do direct mail with postcards, is that people tend to hand them out. I mean, I always got calls from people that I didn't send the card to.
Okay.
And so apparently, what happens is that I'm marketing to businesses. Is that a postcard arrives at the business, either somebody sees it laying around that it didn't send it to and says, oh, that's interesting, or it's received by somebody who says, Joe might be interested in this, and just flips it over to Joe. They at least have to handle it because it's paper sitting there.
Absolutely. Okay. I love physical media, too, and because the thing about electronic media, which is great, love email, love all that stuff, is the second you turn away from your computer or turn your computer off, it's gone.
Yes.
Whereas a letter or a postcard or a DVD or a CD or a book, you put it on the desk and you come back and it's still there.
Right.
And what I also love is, as you discovered for these postcards, is they're portable. I can hand, of course I can forward an email to somebody, but, they may lose it. They don't need more email. But how often does somebody get a postcard handed to them or a book handed to them? It doesn't happen that often. You may get 20 emails forwarded to you a day.
Right.
But how many times a year does somebody hand you a book or hand you a postcard? So you can count them on the fingers of one hand.
So we have tremendous success. Well, here's what's interesting about these things. We've found this last year is that we would do direct mail campaigns and get very low response. And my databases are pretty small. I'm talking about 1,000 or 2,000 people. You know, we don't have a lot. It's very difficult for me to do a lot of testing because I have such small groups.
Sure.
What I found is that we would send them a direct mail sequence of maybe two or three letters and then follow up with a couple of emails. The engineers that would respond always said, wow, saw those three letters you sent me. Those were really interesting, really entertaining. I really liked those. But they would answer the email that they got. They wouldn't answer. They read the direct mail, but they didn't. They would only answer the emails. So I'm not sure what that means for our business, because we are getting attention and we are getting we are calling them to making them aware that we're out there and what we provide, but they just apparently it's too much work to type in the website or to pick up the phone. But when the email arrives, then they say, yeah, I'm interested in this.
Well, and then one of the lessons of direct marketing is if that works, keep doing it.
Well, yeah, I guess so what we're doing with the direct mail is we're setting the stage for the email.
Mm-hmm. Well, let me give a quick rundown of what direct marketing is, for people for whom this is new. Because I know, most of our listeners know, but some people may not know, and some people may, quite frankly, may need a review. One of the things direct marketing says is don't run general-purpose ads in general-purpose media, which is unfortunately what kills so many small businesses or technical businesses. The ad salesperson comes to your door, or the Yellow Pages person comes, and they persuade you of something, and next thing you know, you've written a huge check, and you've bought supposedly some kind of advertisement, and nothing happens. And in direct marketing, we say, okay, we don't want to go that way. Let's figure out where our customers are, what are they reading, what are their addresses if we can get them, and we want to, as closely as we possibly can, we want to put our ads in front, our sales messages in front of the right audience. So that's kind of step one. And then step two is we want to send them stuff, and we want to send them as much stuff as we can. And we want to send them stuff that's relevant to them. We don't want to be entertaining. We don't want to be creative. We don't want to be cute. We don't want to be mysterious. We want to send them something that they perceive as useful, that they want to stop and read, that they get benefit. I'm very big in my own advertising to make sure that there's benefits to reading the ad. Do you know what I mean, John?
Oh, absolutely. That's what my criteria for our newsletter is. There has to be something educational in every issue, something entertaining, and then at the end we hit them with some kind of advertising.
There you go. It's a really good model. Advertising is not, or direct response, direct marketing type advertising is not about buy from me, buy from me, buy from me, buy from me. First it is, hey, I know something about what you're facing.
Yep.
And I have a solution, and here's what it's all about. And, that's going to catch somebody's attention. And then if you put things in your letters that they, or postcards or whatever medium you're using, that they can use right now, that's
yep.
like that's a demonstration that, God, not only does this guy know what my problem is, and not only does he seem to have a solution for it, he's already showing me things that I can use right now. I want to go further with this. So that's sort of first is targeting where your message is going to go. Don't never let an ad salesperson give you any kind of advice about where you should advertise. You've got to be the one to figure out where your customers are and what they're reading and where they're going and what they're looking at. And that's up to you. Never leave that up to anybody else.
Here's how I would modify what you're saying on that is I would say. you want to be very specific about who you're talking to, because as small business people, we can't market to everybody. We have
right.
to pick. We have to pick a target of this group of people with this particular sort of problems, and we're going to market to them and be very personal to them about their specific problem. That's how, because my competitors, for the most part, in some of the things that I do, are $2 billion companies, $500 million to $2 billion companies. They market to everybody with a very generic kind of offering because they're trying to get volume. They want to sell thousands and thousands and thousands of pieces of product. And they have oodles more money than I have. They have full page magazine ads, a huge trade show booths. I mean everything. The way I attack them is by picking out a subsegment of their market that doesn't necessarily respond to that and to broad advertising, and direct market to them with a device that looks specifically for what they want. For example, if they do plastic injection molding, I have a plastic injection molding device.
Mm-hmm.
And he looks at that and says, wow, look at this. My factory does plastic injection molding. This says plastic injection molding right on it. Wow,
mm-hmm.
That's for me. As opposed to the generic one that comes from the big guy. So you have to actually do all the things that you were just talking about, but do it for a very specific segment of the population.
This is such a good point. I mean, very sometimes, you know, would-be entrepreneurs look at these big companies and, you know, despair. Oh, how could I ever find a place in that marketplace? Look at these guys. They've got a 20-acre sales booth at the annual convention.
Right.
They've got 18 four-color page ads in the industry magazine. My God, they have 18,000 salespeople. How could I ever get in there? Well, John just explained how you get in there with
yep.
minimal money. It really is a matter of imagination and ingenuity, not capital and having, you know, $1 million in the bank.
Yeah, exactly. Because if you talk to them in their language about their unique and specific problem in their unique and specific market, then you become you get a lot more attention really fast.
Yep.
As opposed to the big guys don't care. You know, if you take, you know, a small slice, a little 1% slice of their pie, they aren't going to really miss that. And they're not
right.
going to come after you. But for you, that 1% of that huge pie might be a fantastic number. And that you could do really well with, because you
yep.
become the guy who provides, you know, the XYZ solution for this problem.
Yep. Yep. So never feel that you can't compete because somebody's bigger or has a bigger ad budget. It really,
yeah.
it's almost irrelevant. You're right. It's a matter of targeting the right market, the right section of the market with the right message. And then there's another piece of direct marketing that we should talk about. And I'd like to know how you handle this is, a lot of people think that ads are, you run an ad and you put your phone number and the whole thing's going to be done in one step. You know, someone's going to see your ad, they're going to call up, and you're going to talk on the phone for 2 minutes, and a huge check is going to be written. In reality, it usually takes multiple steps to close a sale.
Oh, yeah.
And this is something I kind of knew from experience, but it was great when I had it reinforced by Dan. And then, of course, Dan is like, you know, a master of two-step selling, which is that your initial ad is designed to generate a response. And this brings us back to sort of the core of direct marketing. One of the things you're trying to do with direct marketing is not necessarily sell right away, but get all the people that could be customers to raise their hand and take a step closer to you.
Yep. Exactly.
Right? And so like, you know, a typical way in the technical world is to publish a really good white paper. You know,
oh yeah, and that works well for everything. For instance, if I have a hothouse where I raise tomatoes, and you I see some ad that says, hey, there's 5 things you should know about how to raise better hothouse tomatoes, I'm probably just going to, hey, it's a free report. I'll get into that. So I'll sign up for that. Here, send me that free report. And now
exactly.
you have somebody to correspond with, and not essentially market to right away, not try to sell to right away, but somebody you can market to over time. And that's worth a lot of money to have that contact, because now you've got somebody who's going to be on your list who you can mail and talk to until they die.
Exactly, because the reality is, John, you're talking about direct mail. Direct mail, I think, is really the ultimate marketing tool.
Mm-hmm.
As devoted I am to the internet, I realize, gee, if I could put something physical in somebody's hands, that pretty much trumps anything I can do online. However,
yeah.
Direct mail is expensive. Or let's put it this way: you write pretty big checks for your direct mail. Now, that's okay if I'm putting the right mail in the right person's hands at the right time. And this is why we want to do two-step selling or lead generation selling, which is the free report, the free white paper, the free whatever, that is custom tailored to our market. And we know that anybody that asks for that free report is A, interested in what we do, and then B, of course, once we deliver the free report, and it's a good free report, we've half sold them. So if I know somebody needs what I've got, I mean, I know they need it because they've raised their hand, and I've had a chance to demonstrate to them that I'm pretty good at it and probably, you know, and a solution that they should take seriously, at that point, it makes sense to invest dollars in that sale. Now, where a lot of people get screwed up in marketing is they're random, you know, and they throw money at this and they throw money at that, and somebody, you know, wanders in the door and they invest hours or days or months trying to sell them. And they don't have a plan, they don't have a system, they don't have a way. And I think, you know what, I think this is one of the keys to Dan's method, and it's certainly been the key to my success and I'm sure to yours, is because you've got a direct marketing system, you're generating leads all the time, right?
Yeah, oh, absolutely.
So you're never sitting around going, oh my God, the phone hasn't rung in a week. What are we going to do? And then, you know, somebody shows up and you pounce on them. I'm never in that position. You're never in that position. My students are never in that position because they've invested the time in generating, creating a lead generation system. So they've got so many leads coming in that they can approach the sales process calmly and rationally and strategically. You know, spend money where it makes sense. Spend time where it makes sense. Spend time with the clients it makes sense to spend time with. You follow?
Absolutely. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And I'm sure you've got a system
for
doing that, for generating the lead, and then for how you deal with the lead, how you evaluate prospects. I'm sure there's all this stuff going on in your selling.
You know, I had an interesting experience with I wrote a book, co-authored it with Perry Marshall on industrial Ethernet, which is a hot topic among my market. And I used that. It's kind of interesting. I would go to these meetings. For example, I was at a meeting when I was in England with nine engineers, and none of them have business cards. But, you know, and I want their business cards because I want to be able to market to them over the years and contact them later. So, so what I did was I pulled out the book and I said, okay, anybody who gives me a business card gets a free book. Oh, wow. They all go run into their offices, grab their business cards, and come back and give me a business card. So one of the guys that works for me said, John, that's so expensive. That book costs us $26. And I go, that's cheap. I'll buy leads in my business all day long for $26 a lead.
Or absolutely.
I'll buy a name for $26.
Absolutely. And look what happens. Not only do you have the name, but they have your book. So when you mail to them, you're not mailing to a cold stranger that's never heard of you. You're mailing to somebody that's been carrying you around for days in their briefcase.
That's right. Right. So I consider that really cheap because I'll be sending them things now for the next 5 or 10 years.
So let's say to everybody listening to this, whatever you do, whatever you're doing, whatever you're selling, one of the things you can do that will totally change your life is write up just start with a report, you know, 3 pages of some really useful information that your prospects could use. Like, for instance, if you're a dentist, you know, how to pick a good dentist, you know, how to avoid extra trips to the dentist you don't need, what to do in a dental emergency, you know, all these kind of things that people kind of would like to know if they're starting to think about going to a dentist.
You know,
right?
Here's what happens there, Ken, is that most people have this I'll call that technical information. What to do in a dental emergency is a piece of technical information. But the holders of that information devalue it. We all have specific great technical information that other people would like to know, but we think that because we know it, that everybody knows it. And that's the biggest thing that holds back everybody from writing these little reports.
There you go. This is so important. You know it, so you think everybody knows it, and how valuable could it be? And yet, those little things that you know are maybe your best advertising and best lead generation ever.
Exactly.
And if we could add one more point to this too, give up some of your best stuff. I mean, don't hold back. Don't say, well, I'm not going to tell them the really good stuff. I'm going to hold that back. I forget who it was that said this to me, but it was really quite smart. And I should have picked this up myself, having been in the music business long ago. Take a band, right? And the band's dream is to become famous. And if they're famous, they get to do a lot of concert tours and make a lot of money and sell a lot of records. So being famous in the music world is a good thing. So how do you become famous? Well, you beg radio stations to play your song. Because the more radio stations that play your song, the more people hear it, the more people will show up at your concerts and have the great concert experience and buy the CD and so on. So do musicians send their worst stuff and say, well, see, we got 10 songs, and this one's really good, but we don't want to give it away. We don't want it to play for free on the radio, so we're going to hide that one, and we'll send them this one that's kind of okay, but it's not great. No, that's not how they do it. They take their strongest song, their best song, and in essence, they give it away. They're praying that somebody will abuse this song and play it everywhere for free and never give them a dime. Why? Because then they get heard, and then people show up at their shows, and people buy their other music, and they become famous. And this is I would say this is the same principle for information. If you've got some really good thing, some piece of knowledge, experiment with the idea of giving it away to your prospects. You may find it's the best advertising you could ever do.
Yep.
So Grace, we've covered a lot of ground. Last piece I want to cover is this, and you mentioned that you started with learning direct market. First of all, switching your attitude, right? Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm a technologist, but if I want to make money, I better be a marketer and a sales expert too.
Yep.
Then you learned how to speak to a market in its own language and how important that is. You learned how to use that knowledge to generate leads, to create sales systems online and offline. You learned some of the fine points of face-to-face selling. It's interesting, at the end of this, but at this point, you're now working on yourself, I guess. I mean, that's what really psycho-cybernetics is all about.
Exactly. And part of the problem, one of the things that held me back, I picked up some great information from you, from Dan Kennedy, from John Mendoza, and I was armed with an incredible set of skills now. But I didn't believe in myself and didn't have the self-confidence and didn't have the right attitude, the right positive attitude and have positive expectations. And that's what I walked into psycho-cybernetics and found. Wow, this is the missing piece. This is where you have to have your mind, where you get your mind tuned up and focused. And let me tell you a quick story. One of the most incredible things, and I've read this over and over and over, and I know you talk about this in the book that you published last year, I think. I think it was last year you sent out the book about the different it was a bunch of like small letters you wrote or blog entries.
Yeah, it was a collection of letters. The System Club.
Yeah, excellent. It was not. I think it's the idea of gratitude. I run into this over and over and over again. If you start out in the morning thinking about number one, I live in the United States of America. I don't live in Pakistan or some Bangladesh or some destitute place. I live in a wonderful country. I'm healthy. I've got a great wife, I've got kids, whatever it is, you know, you got a little bit of money in the bank, I get to enjoy, you know, I enjoy life, I've got a great place to go to work, I'm not going to a factory and putting the same screw in the same hole all day long. I mean, you think through all of the things that you have going for you, you put you in a great frame of mind for the rest of the day. Everything starts with gratitude, and right now I'm more grateful than ever in my life, because 2 weeks ago I had a horrible car accident, totaled the car, I ended up crawling out the windshield and saying, wow, I'm fine, I had a slight bruise on my leg, but I'm alive to enjoy Christmas with my family. So it really put everything in perspective and made me even more grateful for all of the wonderful things I have in my life. And that's the first step in getting yourself into a positive frame of mind, is to think about how wonderful and how it is that you have all the things that you already have.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, let's face it, it may be, you know, some people listening to this call may be in tough situations. You know, maybe it may not have a long list, or they may not think they have a long list until they work on it, but, you know, maybe they don't have their financial situation in order, or their family situation in order. I mean, they may have, and yet, if that's when you really need to work your gratitude.
Yeah.
You know, because look, I'll tell you, there was a time in my life when I could not walk easily without extreme pain. So for me, I've had we'll talk about that in a second. You know, so to me, any day that I can eat and I can walk down the street pain-free is already a great day, because I know what the other side of that is like. So that's been a big help to me. And so really, it is a matter of your mindset and basically tuning your mind. You know, you can tune in to all the things that are wrong and all the limitations and all the hardships and so on, or you can tune in to the great things. I just got back from a month in Europe, and I'll tell you, I loved it. I loved England, I loved Germany, I loved Switzerland, I loved Italy. They're great places, and those are pretty good countries. And you know what? I mean, we have listeners from all over the world on this call, but I'll tell you what, there's a reason so many people want to move to the United States. Yeah. After a month on the road, I couldn't wait to get back to North America, because I kind of include Canada in that too. I realized we've got a great deal here. So that was a great eye-opener. Great eye-opener for me. You know, once a student, I was speaking somewhere and somebody asked, what's been your biggest challenge in business? You know, and I was like, wow, I never really thought about that. And I really, you know, it was a serious question, so I gave it some serious thought. And the answer that came to me was, you know, the biggest, kind of, a lot of things have happened to me. I broke my back when I was 28. The thing never healed properly and got broken again when I was 35. Between 28 and 40, I probably only had one or two productive years. I mean, I still worked, but they were not the most productive years of my life. I had a partner once that literally ran. It's almost a archetypal. He ran off with our money to Mexico.
Oh, gosh.
I mean, you know, just when I finally got out of debt, and I finally had a bit. All of a sudden, my partner in this venture is gone. Next thing I know, he's taking his family to Mexico with our company's money, and it brought me right back to zero. I had some kind of a similar but different thing happen with a bunch of colleagues, so-called colleagues, a couple of years ago, and I had some real hardships, you know. But you know, when I was thinking about it, I realized, you know, the biggest obstacle to my business, me.
Absolutely, that's exactly
absolutely.
What I was going to say. I knew exactly where you were going with that. Every single one of us on this call, the biggest impediment you have to living a wonderful, incredibly happy, successful life is the stuff between your ears.
Yep.
And one of the another technique that I've learned besides after gratitude is to start back and think through all of the times you've been really successful in your life, and you start back. One of the things Matt teaches is start back if you were born. You know, you were of all the things that could have happened. You actually, you know, the egg was fertilizer and you were born, and then you learned to maybe ride a bike, and then you learned to, you did some of this in high school, you won a swim meet in high school, and you think through step by step, I graduated from college, and I did this at this company, and made this happen, I found this wonderful woman to marry, whatever it is, you go through all the years and think about all the great successes you've had, and then you go on all the business successes. If you honestly do that for 15 minutes, you feel so wonderful and so ready to tackle the day. So you start with the gratitude, and then you think about all the times you've been successful, and that's what's important, is don't think about the economy. I try to avoid the media as much as possible now. I have a picture of six different things that I want to generate in my life, and I keep that handy. And whenever I have a negative thought, I just concentrate on what it's going to be like when that thing comes to fruition.
Well, and isn't that another big piece of this too? Is
yep.
No matter where you're at, you have a clear vision of what you want to get to.
Right.
Right. And that becomes, instead of life becoming dodging, you know, things and you know, getting out of the way of things, life becomes heading towards something that magnetically pulls you forward because it's something
right.
that you invest in and you believe in.
And then one of the things that's important to do is once you've identified what that is every day you've got to identify what is important for me to work on today that's going to get me closer to one of those major goals. I mean, you may have a whole list of urgent things. Okay, I've got to get this application done for a loan. I've got to get this particular thing done. I get that. You get all these urgent things done, things that are time driven. But you have to have your list of two or three things that are important, meaning that they're going to move you closer to goal, and you're going to work on those and make sure that those get done today. The three more get done tomorrow. If you do one or two every day. Then by the end of the year, you could do 750 or 800 things to move you closer to your goal. So what would your life be like if you actually did 800 things in 2009 that moved you toward one of your major goals you want to accomplish in life?
Oh, that is just beautiful. That is so, and you know, and there's no hot air here. I mean, this is absolutely real. It's totally, no matter where you're at, this is within your power.
Yep.
And so I may, you know, maybe today you have to buy a snowblower, you have to pay your traffic ticket, you've got to shovel the walk. I mean, there's all this stuff you got to do. But then there's this thing that really means something to you, and it's up to you to figure out, okay, what can I do today before the sun sets, that's going to take me a step closer.
And it could be just sending a fax. It could be one phone call. It could be reading a page out of something. It could be 10 minutes. You're going to just generate some ideas. You know, I'm not talking about 4 hours. You're going to spend 4 hours working on your goal. You're going to take some small step, because the accumulation of those 700 or 800 small steps in 2009 is going to create incredible momentum in your life.
Oh, this is so good. This is so. And you look at certain people and you see, oh my God, look at what that guy's accomplished. I mean, how on earth did he get all that done? If you deconstruct how anybody gets anywhere good, it's exactly this method that John mentioned. They know what's important to them, and they take care of all the business that they've got to take care of during the course of the day, but they always make sure they're doing something every day, no matter how seemingly trivial, that's moving them to where they want to be. And this cumulative thing is something we really underestimate the power of. And a way to think about this is, you know, if you put a jar on your desk, and every time you come home, you empty your pockets of your change and you put it in the jar. At first, there's nothing in the jar. You know, there's a couple of coins. But if you do that every day, you'll get to the point where the jar is packed and you have to empty it out. And my God, you've got $80 in quarters in there, you know. And it's sort of the same principle with moving towards a goal. But you have to know what you're doing and part of, the big part of the investment, by the way, is just to think, okay, tomorrow, what am I going to do to move me closer?
Exactly. It may be something that's so far off in the future, but you can take one little step today. Okay.
Yep.
One of my goals is to I actually would like to live in Italy 6 months a year and have a condo on the Adriatic Ocean. So I'm, you know, taking every day I think about now what little thing can I do today that's going to get me closer to that goal. I mean, it's still way off in the future for me, but I'm working toward it.
Absolutely.
And hopefully in 2009 I'm going to take at least 300 steps toward that.
Yep. Yep. There's you know, I hate to use the word magic because it's like, wow, how do you pin that down? But there's a certain magic that happens when you figure out what you really want. And by the way, this is not necessarily obvious. You know, sometimes we're programmed to think, well, I should want X, Y, and Z because that's what my family wanted and that's what the media says I should want. You know, what you want is what you want. And assuming it's ethical and good for you and good for other people, whatever it is, that's what it is. You know?
That's right.
Some people may say, well, who would want to live in Italy on the Adriatic? You know, for some people, that's not going to do it. But for John, that does it. Everybody has the thing that does it for them. And being, you know, reminding yourself, first of all, figuring out what that thing is, which can take effort sometimes, and then reminding yourself of it, and then figuring out, okay, what can I do today? And then the next day, what can I do today? And the next day, and what can I do today? It is a kind of magic, and things will, sometimes you get thrown a break, you know, because you have that thing clearly in mind, and every day you're taking a step forward. Sometimes extra things just happen that you could never anticipate.
You've got to keep, and you keep pictures around of that. See, I have pictures of different places on the Adriatic, different cities, different condo complexes, and so I have those to look at. Oh, yeah, that's what I'm working for. Oh, yeah, that's going to be really cool. So you want to do that. If it's a nice car, you want to have a Maserati or whatever it is, you keep pictures of Maseratis around so that you constantly remind yourself, oh, yeah, it's going to be so cool to drive that. And, you know, you want that continually repetitive instructions to your subconscious about that. And that's how things work. One of the things I'd like to say is that, sure, all of the marketing I learned from Dan Kennedy has been great. The internet marketing I learned from you has been wonderful. The sales stuff I learned from John Mendoza has been terrific, and all this other stuff. But it all came. The really thing that puts it together is when you get your mind right and use your mind to more of its capabilities. That's when things really start to work out well for you.
And everybody, I believe, can just get this book. It's called Psycho-Cybernetics. It's by Maxwell Maltz. And, and just, you know, quick story, Maltz was a very good plastic surgeon. And basically, this was in the era before Hollywood plastic surgery. His main thing was fixing people that had scars or injuries or, you know, different things. And what he discovered was this weird thing. He was very good at what he did, and he'd completely fix somebody's looks. And some people would go, oh, this is just what I wanted. This is great. And they'd be happy. But then there were other people who'd look in the mirror and they would still feel bad about themselves and about their prospects and about how they fit into the world. And he became really puzzled by this because he thought, gee, what's going on here? You know, this person now looks beautiful and they feel ugly. What's happening? And he put his plastic surgery aside and delved into practical psychology. And, you know, I got that book when I was in college. I was going, you know, and I was going through a rough time and, somebody recommended it and I read it and it was so liberating to realize that, gee, I have a lot of control over the quality and content of my thoughts. And ultimately my feelings, and ultimately where I end up in life. Mm-hmm. And when I got that message, wow, I was like, oh, this is good.
That's an incredible key to this whole business of succeeding as an entrepreneur. And it's stuff that it's hard, you know, it's very hard for me to talk about to other people who aren't into this stuff. Because my wife, for example, is, you know, I've tried to talk to her about it, but she just doesn't. It just kind of seems kind of spooky to her, the way it all works. But,
well, you know, when you're in a performance driven activity like sports, a lot of athletes are into psychocybernetics and similar things. Entrepreneurs, certainly, or musicians, anybody that has to get up there and do it, make it happen. You know, Tiger Woods. You know, people don't realize this. Tiger Woods was trained in all kinds of mental imagery and self affirmation and all kinds of things from an early age. He was being taught golf. He was also being taught how to use his mind correctly.
Well, you know, and you know, Muhammad Ali also. Muhammad Ali used to lay down and see and picture every single punch he was going to throw and that his opponent was going to throw.
Mm-hmm.
He pictured the whole bout all the way until in the middle of the third round. All of a sudden, he was going to get an opportunity and he was going to lay the guy flat and win the fight. And sure enough, he would picture that every day. He would go through every punch by punch, and then he'd get into the ring, and it would happen exactly as he pictured it. Because
well,
what happens is your muscle memory does not know that this is not happening, that this is not reality. So your body actually thinks that this is real. It's that it's done this over and over and over again. So when you get into the actual situation, this is just old hat for it because it's done this, but been doing this for the last, you know, 10 weeks or something.
Exactly. It's comfortable. It's natural. It feels right. It flows.
Yeah.
That's why when certain people whose minds were not working for them would get these operations and look better because of their mental habits, they couldn't go with it because they mentally weren't able to accept themselves and enjoy themselves, you know, and enjoy being having an improvement. And maybe you found yourself in maybe a similar situation where, you know, you got your business going, the money was happening, you clearly knew what you were doing, but there was some nagging thing that was just kind of not quite feeling right. So it sounds like what you've done is trained your mind to, you know, embrace and enjoy all the things that are going well.
Yeah, it's incredible technology. I really encourage everybody to get the book and delve into it. It can really change your life.
You know, and we're talking, I think the last time I saw it, I think it was in the bookstores for $9.95, you know, so we're not talking, and you know what, if you can't even come up with that, I'm sure it's in the library.
Well, you can get it on eBay, you can get all sorts of things on eBay that are for probably 99 cents, too.
Yeah, there you go. Well, John, this is great. I think we really covered a lot of ground.
Right.
Yeah. And your business continues to grow, and you know we're having this interview now, sort of at the end of a really tumultuous year for the world financially, and yet you're very positive, and not just in a Pollyanna sense, but you are coming up with plans and strategies, and you're moving everything forward as opposed to, you know, cowering and you know, dialing it down.
We're planning on a 20% increase in business and probably a 200% increase in net profit next year. We're really thinking we can ramp the business up, and now's the time that we can grab market share. I'm hiring 2 more marketers this year, so we'll be able to get a lot more stuff pumped out. I'm increasing the marketing budget. We're developing 3 new products. I mean, we're really attacking this thing. There's no recession. I'm not going to have a recession in my office.
Beautiful. Well, John Rinaldi, thank you so much for sharing some of the fruit of your experience with us today. I'm really excited about getting this call out to people. I think it'll be helpful whether you've been in business for 20 years or whether you're just, you know, thinking about getting started. I think you really hit the things that make the biggest difference in succeeding and having your own business.
Great. Thank you, Ken.
All right, well, we'll talk soon, and have a great holiday.
You too. Goodbye.